Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Mark Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks, and you're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Mike Schotte here, filling in for Joel Cordes, who is off doing unspeakable things, one can assume. Big show planned for you this evening, as got a lot to talk about. Crazy week in the NFL. Absolutely absurd time of year with that, and of course the NCAA tournament, which we have to talk about. That's coming up second on the program. And Ethan Noroff, as always, is with us, and we're going to chat a little NBA at the end of the program. A special guest tentatively planned is Cecil Lammy, NFL insider from ESPN Denver. He has yet to call in, and we will talk some of the biggest NBA or NFL news when he comes in. However, we're going to bring on my co-host, Ethan Noroff. Ethan, how are we doing this evening?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's been a bit of a hectic week on the NFL side of things, but I'm sure the NBA side has been a little busy for you as well.
Absolutely. You know, trade deadline's behind us, but that doesn't mean moves aren't still happening. So plenty to discuss for the next hour.
Ethan, of course, is the NBA assistant editor, I believe is your official title, or associate?
Assistant.
Assistant NFL or NBA editor over at Bleacher Report. And I am the NFL associate editor over at Bleacher Report. So, of course, you can always check out our stuff at bleacherreport.com or follow us on Twitter, me at Schotte, S-C-H-O-T-T-E-Y, and Ethan at Mr. _ Noroff, N-O-R-O-F. We've got a big show planned for you, so let's jump right in. Going to keep a couple of our bigger targets just in case Mr. Lammy calls in. So first, I want to just get your initial impressions, one of the somewhat bigger NFL stories that isn't getting a lot of traction these days, but still pretty big, is that the Dallas Cowboys and the Washington Redskins have been hit with a pretty severe cap penalty against them this year because of some things that they did last year, front-loading contracts in an uncapped year to what the NFL says, create a competitive imbalance. I want to get your thoughts on just... Is it fair that you, do you think it's fair that the NFL is doing this? Do you think this is somehow targeting the Redskins and the Cowboys? What are your thoughts on the situation?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because the NFL said that it had sent several warnings to both teams and both teams kind of swept it under the rug and ignored it. And if that's the case, then, you know, both the Redskins and the Cowboys should have seen something like this on the horizon as a possibility. But almost every team every year, whether it's in the form of a signing bonus or some other restructuring type of deal, finds ways to work around the salary cap and create more cap space. So is it really fair that these two teams are suffering when the other, you know, all the other teams in the league have done some form of this, maybe not as explicit? I'm not sold on that.
Yeah, I think the, you know, every team does some of this. When you look at, for instance, the Miles Austin deal. It was an uncapped year last year, so they paid him a ridiculous amount of money on a long-term deal so that the rest of the year is under his deal. He's actually being paid relatively little, at least at base salary, which, you know, doesn't count against the cap. So all of a sudden you have a great player in Miles Austin who doesn't count against your cap that much. You know, you compare that to equivalent wide receivers in the league, you know, if he's only counting $2 or $3 million against the cap, equivalent players are counting, you know, $8, $9, $10 million against the cap. You know, that does, in a sense, create competitive imbalance. Now, the problem that comes in, of course, is it was an uncapped year, and the CBA wasn't governing the NFL at that point. And so you have these, essentially, these 32 separate businesses, and I'm going to use the word colluding, to keep prices low or to do at least something with prices that, you know, the union wasn't involved in, the, you know, the courts weren't involved with. They were literally telling each other, hey, let's not do this because we don't want to, you know, pay people more money than we necessarily have to. And but you're right that it sounds like they kept warning these teams over and over and over, hey, don't do this, don't do this. We're going to keep approving these contracts, but please stop this. And they just kept doing it. And you're right that they were, you know, they shouldn't have been surprised when this happened. The owners' meetings are happening right now down in Palm Beach. And from what I hear, the Redskins and the Cowboys are going to try to do something about it this week. So even though this was, you know, this penalty came out a couple weeks ago, it's going to start to heat up again because these two teams are going to try to get something done so they don't have to, you know, deal with these big penalties. And there's a bunch of players, including, I apologize, I can't think of his name. There's a bunch of big players that need to be re-signed by these two teams. They don't have the money right now to do it. So we'll see what happens. The Redskins obviously pulled a huge trade for Robert Griffin III earlier this summer or this offseason, and they're hoping to surround him with a bunch of talent for agency, and they can't do that with these cap penalties. Let's move on to our bigger stories. We'll jump right in. Peyton Manning signed with the Denver Broncos. It blew my world for a spin. Obviously, as an NFL editor, I had to jump right in and get this going. Give me your initial thoughts on what Peyton Manning in Denver means.
Well, I think you started to allude to it right there, and it means no more Tim Tebow. But on a more serious note, I was shocked. I thought that he was going to head to San Francisco and play with the 49ers. I thought that with that defense that's there in San Francisco in place and with the talent around him or what would have been around him on offense, I thought that was a really good situation for him to go and try and win a Super Bowl, because what else is he trying to do at this point in his career? I think Denver is very comfortable for him. They're bringing in some familiar faces for him to operate with. He has a front office that's fully behind him. As much as they were against Tebow, they're fully supporting Manning. But they're kind of going all in here. They don't have a plan B. John Elway said it himself. So if Manning might have to miss some time or he doesn't prove as healthy as they're hoping, it could be something that really sets back Denver as a franchise. So it's a move that, you know, I mean, any team would be great, that much better with Peyton Manning. But it's a really interesting landing spot for him, and I'm curious to see how he does.
Yeah, I've said it numerous times and probably numerous times on this show that if you take the difference between the Indianapolis Colts without Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts with Peyton Manning, and you simply take that differential and add it to what the Denver Broncos were last season, yes, that's some very simplistic math that probably doesn't hold true. However, if you just look at it that simplistically, that means the Denver Broncos are at least as good, if not that much better than they were last year, which equals a Super Bowl contender. And it's hard not to look at this team that had such a stout defense last year, one of the top defenses in the league, and now see it with at least a competent offense and say, wow, this can be, if not a playoff team, but perhaps a Super Bowl contender. And I think you said it perfectly that if he's healthy, the sky's the limit for this team. But if he's not healthy, you know, this could be one of the biggest mistakes in NFL history, because you've literally not only brought in someone, paid him a ton of guaranteed money to really be the face of your franchise now, but you've also jettisoned Tim Tebow, who was not only the face of your franchise, but was the face of a city for quite a long time. So, you know, even 2 years ago when Tim Tebow wasn't starting, they were still chanting his name. So this could end up being one of the best deals ever or the worst deals ever, and there's not a whole lot in between. Because if you're paying a quarterback that much money and he doesn't take you to the mountaintop, it's essentially a failure. And of course, anytime there's a big move in the NFL, you have to start trickling down and seeing where that leads you. And Tim Tebow, with Peyton Manning in Denver, they all said there's no chance he's staying. Between the agencies bickering about it and between simply the fans unable to kind of wrap their heads around it and the team worrying about fans still clamoring for Tebow with Peyton Manning in town, they had to get rid of him. And it looked like he was going to either the Jacksonville Jaguars, the Miami Dolphins. The Miami Dolphins removed themselves from the list, as did the San Francisco 49ers. And all of a sudden, last minute, the New York Jets jumped into the fray, and the New York Jets ended up with Tim Tebow. They've got a competent quarterback in Mark Sanchez, but Ethan, do you see Tim Tebow competing for the starting job in New York?
If he does, it's not going to be because the coaches think he's superior to Mark Sanchez. It's going to be because of media and fan pressure. I think it's a really weird move, and as somebody who roots for the Jets, I don't see it as something that Mark Sanchez needed at this time. He's already with shaky confidence despite the apology extension that the Jets handed him with about $20 million in new guaranteed money. I don't see how paying a backup quarterback of Tim Tebow's stature to come into New York is going to benefit that team. If they think he's going to come in there and solve locker room issues on his own, they are grossly overestimating his ability to do that. I see it as something to grab headlines and nothing more, but I hope that I'm wrong.
I agree with you there. And when we come back from break, we'll talk a little more Tim Tebow, and we'll get to Bountygate. You're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network.
Finally, those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes, eh? Hey, comrade!
What if he shot me in the face?
That's the risk we were willing to take.
And you choose to thank me by throwing a knife at my head?
There's no crying in baseball!
I want you to know that your father loves you both very much.
But he feels like a girl.
So did Martina Navratilova.
What were you doing exactly?
I was eating pop.
Putting Chet Filipiewicz inside me? But it'll help.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
Welcome back to the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Mike Shoddy, Ethan Noroff with you this evening. Joel Cordes off on vacation. Ethan, we've been talking a little bit of Tim Tebow. I let you have your say. Let me jump into the fray here. I read something really good about Tim Tebow this morning, and surprising not only because I was reading, but also that probably the best Tim Tebow in New York thing I've read has come from Boston. And often Boston people are not level-headed, but Greg Bedard, who writes for the Boston Globe, previously Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and before that the Miami Herald, is no Boston homer. And he basically said about Tim Tebow, if he was brought in for the sole reason that he's younger than Mark Brunell, he's a legitimate threat to Mark Sanchez, then this could be a good deal. Because when you look at kind of the coddled atmosphere around Mark Sanchez, he's always had, you know, starters that could never touch him and really no threat to his job. And if Tim Tebow could be that, if a poor game from Mark Sanchez could mean, you know, Tim Tebow is all of a sudden the starter, then it could vastly accelerate the development of Mark Sanchez. Also, Tim Tebow is the hardest worker in football. Everyone has always said that, even before he was drafted, that no one will work harder than Tim Tebow. He's one of the elite work ethic guys in the NFL. Mark Sanchez, by all accounts, is right up there with Matt Leinart and probably the least work ethic capable people in the NFL. So some of that starts to rub off on Sanchez as well, and realize if I'm going to get better at the same rate in which Tim Tebow is getting better, I need to work as hard as him. Put all that together, and it doesn't seem like such a horrible idea. And as much as the three-winged circus is going to happen because it's the Jets and because it's Tim Tebow, as much as I believe truly that the New York media is just going to tear him apart and give him absolutely zero benefit of the doubt for any of his in-your-face evangelical Christian proclivities, all that stuff is going to be probably negative. But I think if those two things come together, the fact that Mark Sanchez absolutely believes there's a threat to his job and some of that work ethic rubs off on him, I think this could end up being a pretty big deal. However, if it fails, if the tough love somehow backfires and Mark Sanchez collapses, then we're talking about, again, as we said earlier, this could be an all-time horrible deal for the New York Jets.
You know, that's what I worry about. And I just worry from Mark Sanchez's standpoint, you know, he's not a quarterback that's going to come into a game and start bombing passes all over the field. He's not going to take a giant step forward this season. If he does improve, that's great, but he's got a lot of improvement to do. So every time he throws an incompletion or, God forbid, he throws an interception, are they going to be chanting Tebow's name? I know a good deal of people who are already lining up to get his T-shirt, so what's the next step?
I think the final thing that needs to be said about Tim Tebow is that the New York Jets have held on to the Wildcat a little longer than other teams in the NFL. They had Brad Smith around. He was doing some pretty inventive things with that offense before he left town. And now Tony Sparano is part of the offensive staff, and he, of course, used the Wildcat very well in Miami. And Tim Tebow is kind of the – Tim Tebow is what the Miami Dolphins once thought they were getting in Pat White, a quarterback with elite running ability who can also pass the ball with some proficiency. You know, hate on Tim Tebow's passing as much as you want, he's still slightly better than the running backs who've been throwing out of the Wildcats in the NFL for the past 10 years. So with Tim Tebow, you throw in some of these Wildcat-type plays, it's something that's already been a part of your offense because of Brad Smith. And if Mark Sanchez is having a rough game, you can enter that into the fray, and it's not drastically changing what you've already been doing as a franchise in the last 5-10 years. Let's move on. There was another really big story in the NFL right around the Tim Tebow, at least on my computer. They broke within 20 seconds of each other. Tim Tebow was traded to the New York Jets, and then the NFL hammered down some pretty insane penalties to the New Orleans Saints due to quote-unquote bounty gate. Sean Payton, the head coach of the New Orleans Saints, suspended for a year without pay, along with a hefty fine. Former defensive coordinator of the Saints, now of the Rams, Greg Williams, suspended indefinitely. One can assume he's simply done in the NFL. And the general manager of the Saints suspended for 6 games, which might be the most meaningless penalty ever. He also drew a pretty hefty fine. And Joe Witt, defensive line coach or linebackers coach in New Orleans, also suspended for a couple games as well. Ethan, in your opinion, we've talked a lot about bounty gate the past couple of weeks. In your opinion, was this penalty too loose, too harsh, or just right?
I think it was just right. I know a lot of people are going to say that it was too harsh, but what was Goodell supposed to do? I think they really made it worse for themselves by lying initially. I think that really could have possibly even doubled the suspensions that the commissioner was originally thinking about doling out. I think, you know, Roger Goodell sending a message that this will not be tolerated in his league. And as we've seen before, you either play by his rules or you don't play at all. So I think this is not only going to send a message to New Orleans and everybody involved, but I think it's going to send a message around the league that says don't get caught doing something you're not supposed to. Otherwise, the consequences will be great.
And alongside these stiff penalties, there was a memo sent out to all 32 teams, a signature demanded on what is essentially an oath to not enact any of these bounty programs on your team in the upcoming year. And alongside that memo was a note that these will be signed before each upcoming year for the rest of eternity, as long as the NFL exists. There will be no bounty programs in the NFL, and Goodell, in a sense, with these penalties to the Saints, is saying, or this will happen to you. If he had simply slapped the Saints on the wrist and sent out these memos saying, we're not going to do bounties anymore, that essentially means nothing, because they see a slap on a wrist and other teams will still continue to do the same. This was saying, this can happen to you, and this is the NFL equivalent to the death penalty. I've not seen a franchise this hamstrung by the NFL in my entire time covering it, and even historically, I don't know if you can point to such an extreme example of a franchise being penalized. I don't think it's too much. I think it's just right as well. And if anything, I would lean toward not being enough. When I first looked at this issue in general, I thought Greg Williams was done in the NFL. And I think that's a no-brainer. Sean Payton, a year, okay. I'll get on board with that. I'm really upset, though, however, with Mickey Loomis, the GM, getting an in-season penalty. Because for a general manager, in-season is, quite frankly, not that big of a deal. As a Detroit Lions fan, I remember back in the day when Matt Millen used to take 4 or 5 day weekends. Obviously, Matt Millen, not a very good GM. But he was able, with his work schedule, to simply go home to his home in Pennsylvania, watch his son, who's now in the Marines, play football, and essentially not even come back for the game. Mickey Loomis could have done that as well. He doesn't need to be there. Most of his work is done in the off season, and during the season, he's essentially a yes man for, okay, we need this roster spot filled. Which one of, you know, these former players of coach can we bring in, because he already knows the system. Honestly, not a big deal for Mickey Loomis to be suspended. I would have suspended him right now up until the start of the season. He's not there for the draft. He's not there for the duration of free agency. That would have sent a message. That would have said, this is serious. You cannot lie to us when we investigate you in matters like this. And again, you cannot enact and knowingly have bounty systems on your team, because if we're ushering in an era of player safety in the NFL, we can't have our coaches having hit squads out on the field. So if anything, I would lean towards a little bit too loose, because there were some penalties where I thought they could have come down harsher and kowtowed to Tom Benson, who is one of the more long-tenured, prolific, and influential owners in the NFL.
I agree. I mean, look, at the end of the day, there's no place for this in the NFL. And the fact that it was going on for so long and Greg Williams was operating on this system before the Saints, I couldn't agree more that I think he should be done in this league, because clearly he's proved he's got no respect for what's supposed to be done. So why should the league show him any by letting him back in?
Other NFL news before our quick break. Curtis Lofton last night signs with the Saints, which has been surprising. They also signed Roderick Bunkley earlier in the week. They've been able to attract free agents, even in the wake of Bountygate and these suspensions. They might not have been knocked down as much of a peg as people have thought, or as much as they might have deserved. Marion Barber retired from the league after 7 seasons. He probably could have still gone, but he would have been fighting for camp spots and fighting for end-of-roster spots, and he simply hung it up. He's got more than enough money. He doesn't need to play anymore. Asante Samuel is rumored to be on the market still with the Philadelphia Eagles. Because of his $19 million cap hit, most teams are not biting. He's 31 years old. He's still a decent cover corner, but there just aren't enough teams with that sort of cap room to sign him. Of course, if either the Washington Redskins or the Dallas Cowboys find that cap room again in owners' meetings, they might be willing to do a deal with the devil and trade for a player within their division. Finally, both the Stanford and Baylor Pro Days were this week. We got to see Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III with their final tryout in front of NFL teams, and my goodness, did they show off. Early reports out of Baylor was that Robert Griffin had one of the best pro days ever seen by most onlookers, and there were rumors that he might be able to jump Luck into the number one spot. Then Andrew Luck came out and dazzled himself, having what many consider the best quarterback pro day in history. These two are fighting tooth and nail, and let's not just write it off that Andrew Luck can be the number one pick in the draft. I think RG3 is going to do as much as he can to throw himself into the mix to be an Indianapolis Colt. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little college basketball. You're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio.
I look good. I mean, really good.
Hey, everyone! Come and see how good I look! I'm a man who discovered the wheel and built the Eiffel Tower out of metal and bronze. That's what kind of man I am.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Son of a bee sting. She's turning the entire office against us.
Scorpion woman! Loud noises! I don't know what we're yelling about!
I immediately regret this decision.
I'm
Welcome back. This is the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Mike Schotte, Ethan Noroff with you this evening. Joel Cordes is on vacation, but we're glad to be here with you talking a little NCAA basketball. Ethan, the first question I have to ask you, give me the best games from the past week. Of course, the Sweet 16 started on Thursday, and now we're knee-deep into the Elite Eight. Give me the games you liked watching the best.
Wow. Really, the whole tournament has been fantastic. You know, there's been some great underdog stories, but we're starting to see some of the top-tier talent win out here. I think one of the most entertaining games for me personally was actually Kansas against North Carolina State. I thought that was a fascinating game to watch. As much as Michigan State got beat down by Louisville, I thought that was a really interesting game to watch, too. Michigan State really struggled against that Rick Pitino team. It was something that I wasn't expecting to see. Before today, I really liked the way Baylor was playing. They came out with strong efforts. Of course, they lost against Kentucky today, so now they'll be sitting on the sidelines. But those are three games that I really enjoyed watching how they fared in the tournament, some better than others.
I think I will immediately drift over to the other side of the bracket, because the two games I immediately wanted to highlight was, one, a game that I picked inaccurately last week when I said that Wisconsin, the four seed, upset Syracuse. And I think we all kind of sat there and agreed that Wisconsin was just too good on the boards, and without Fab Mello, Syracuse simply wouldn't be able to get it done. Well, neither team really got it done. Wisconsin went cold after a strong start, and Syracuse won in a really low-scoring game, at least for their standards, probably a more Big Ten-style game, winning that game 64-63. And then I was extremely, I shouldn't say that I was rooting for Syracuse, but during that game I got caught up in Syracuse a little bit and really wanted to see them beat the team that I'm not too fond of, the Ohio State Buckeyes. But Ohio State looks pretty much unbeatable at this point. They crushed Cincinnati in the Sweet 16, 81-66, and then again up against the number one seed, beating them by 7 points in what was just a phenomenal game. Aaron Kraft looks like he might be one of the better players that none of us are talking about, not only in this tournament, but perhaps leading up to the NBA draft. You know, not a guy that's going to dazzle you, but a guy who's absolutely going to outwork everyone, and guard play is just simply always needed. Down in the Midwest region, Kansas has been having its way with just about everyone. You mentioned their win against North Carolina State, but then up against the Tar Heels, beating them 80-67. Just phenomenal play by them. We've got only one number one seed, the number one overall. Kentucky is going to match up on the 31st with number four Louisville, and then you've got the two seeds, OSU and Kansas. That'll be our final four matchup. So, Ethan, the next question I have to you, your worst disappointments from the tournament.
Wow. That's a great question. For me, I really thought, as weird as this might sound to some listeners, I really thought Long Beach State was going to beat New Mexico in the first round, and I thought they'd have enough muster behind Casper Ware, really, really special point guard, to make it all the way to the Sweet 16. So to see them get eliminated in the first round wasn't an upset for a lot of people, but personally it was for me. I think for as great of a season as Syracuse had, even though they were forced to play without Fab Mello, it's disappointing to see them go before they should have on paper at least. And I think the other team that disappointed me the most was I was really, really looking to see more from UNC, despite having to play without Kendall Marshall. Really disappointing effort. Even in their wins, I didn't think they looked that great. It's really, really tough. And I wish I could include Duke on this list, but I feel like they disappoint me every season, so that's not a surprise at this point.
Yeah, I couldn't even start thinking about the word disappointment without throwing my Michigan Wolverines into that. I don't want to harp on it because all our listeners know that I'm a fan, and I don't want to seem like I'm just reveling in my own distress, because quite frankly, I almost suspected something like this after their poor showings late in the season. But just such a team that was so well put together, really weathered the storm of the Big Ten and came out towards the top of the Big Ten. I really thought they could do some damage in both the Big Ten and possibly NCAA tournament, and they just fell flat on their face at both. Huge disappointment losing to the Ohio Bobcats, who then, of course, advanced before getting trounced by North Carolina in the Sweet 16. So, you know, ran into a good, obviously good team in Ohio that's going to return a lot of starters next year, but, man, Michigan Wolverines, disappointment. Marquette came into the tournament as a number three seed. Many people thought, or not Marquette, I apologize. Missouri came into the tournament as a number two seed, and many people thought that they deserved a number one. Then they lost to Norfolk State in the first round. I really don't think that there's anything not disappointing about a 15 seed beating a two when you're a fan of that number two seed. Missouri, again, a team that had so much going for it. Many people thought that they were better than even the tournament committee thought they were, and falling flat on their face to one of the smallest mid-major schools out there isn't just a disappointment, that is a colossal disappointment. Finally, the team that Bob Knight once coached for ran into the team that Bob Knight can't even mention by name. And the number four Indiana Hoosiers, I thought, really great team, probably one of the more talented teams in the nation that simply can't get off its butt for long stretches during the game and actually put the ball in the hoop. They had what I would consider a shaky first game against the 13 seed New Mexico State, an even shakier game against the 12 seed VCU, who many people were pulling for both in the stands and at home, and then finally losing in one of the more lopsided, high-scoring games of the tournament, losing to the number one overall seed, Kentucky, in a game in which they were not only outclassed talent-wise, which Kentucky lost in due to you, but frankly outclassed from a coaching perspective. Indiana simply needs to play harder in upcoming years if they want to advance further in the NCAA tournament. Next question for you. Just a second, we've got someone on the phone lines. We got a 303 area code. Thanks for calling to the Average Joe Sports Show.
Hey, it's Cecil Lammy. What's going on, baby?
Cecil, better late than never. How's it going, man?
I was at the park hooping it up with my kids, and I got to tell you, I'm not as good as I once used to be, Shoddy.
All right, let me do me a favor. I'm going to throw you back on hold. We're going to finish up here with NCAA talk. We'll come in and we'll talk a little Peyton Manning and Tim Tebow after the break, okay?
Sounds good, brother.
All right. And, of course, Cecil Lammy, ESPN Insider from ESPN Denver. We will get to him in just a few minutes. Let's finish up with tourney talk here, though, Ethan. Let's just preview the final four quickly before the break. Give me, from the matchups we talked about, UK and Louisville, OSU, KU, give me what you're looking for in both of these games and what you think the national championship matchup is going to be.
Well, I think what I'm looking for from Kansas against Ohio State is going to be a whole lot of Thomas Robinson versus Jared Sellinger. I think it's going to be whatever big man or whichever big man has a better game, their team is going to have a better chance of moving on. From Kentucky-Louisville, honestly, I'm looking for Kentucky to really come out and control that game. Their athleticism is unmatched. Nobody can defend Anthony Davis successfully. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist looks every bit as good as everybody is saying he is. So I look for them to really come out and assert themselves. And I'm picking Kentucky for the national champion. It's been my pick all along. As long as they play up to their talent level, there's just nobody as good as they are in this tournament.
I think Kentucky has a fast-paced style that is conducive to the amount of talent they bring in every year, and they're always seemingly churning that talent out the back end as well, right into the NBA draft. Rick Pitino, of course, doesn't get as many of those one-and-dones and has a slower I don't want to call it quite methodical, but his is a style that during the season, when he has plenty of scouting tape, he knows plenty about players, he can dissect you and pick you apart. Rick Pitino is one of the better basketball coaches of our era. However, in a tournament atmosphere like this, these two teams know a lot about each other, but they don't have, you know, 6 weeks to prepare before the season for this game. This game is going to be up and down the floor. It's going to be very high scoring, and I think in the end, a Calipari coach team is always better than a Pitino coach team at this stage of the tournament, again, simply because their style of play is more conducive to the lack of scouting that's going to be done ahead of time. Ohio State, Kansas, I think you put it perfectly that it's going to be a battle of the big men. If Jared Sellinger starts hot, if he can step out to the three-point line, open this Kansas team up. This is going to be a very long night for the Jayhawks. However, I don't see that happening. Ohio State has seemingly fallen on their faces a couple of times this season. They always seem to let down at the worst possible time, and they haven't run into a team that's this talented over the course of the season, except for Michigan State, who they were able to, go toe-to-toe with, but frankly got outclassed a couple of times as well. So I see Kansas advancing, I see Kentucky advancing, and I see, like you, Kentucky winning the national championship. Let's take a quick break here on the Average Joe Sports Show. When we come back, you heard him, Cecil Lammy is here to talk a little more, Peyton Manning and Tim Tebow, back in 30 seconds.
We want this and that. We demand a share in that and most of that, some of this, less of that, and more of this, plenty of this. We want it now. I want it yesterday. I want more tomorrow. And the demands will all be changed then, so stay awake.
Why are you the way that you are? Honestly, every time I try to do something fun or exciting, you make it not that way. I hate so much about the things that you choose to be.
I have an excellent idea. Let's change the subject.
Let's change the subject. This is the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Mike Schotte, Ethan Noroff. Manning the ship as Joel Cordes is on vacation, and we're going to change the subject to something that we already talked about a little bit, but with Cecil Lammy, our main man from ESPN Denver on the phone lines, we can't help but go back and talk a little bit about Peyton Manning. Cecil, my man, are you still winded from basketball? Can I bring you on, or are you going to sit there and wheeze?
Well, I have been able to catch my breath. Let's just say my belly button isn't as close to my spine as it used to be when I was hooping it up in junior college.
Excellent, excellent. I'm just picturing you in short shorts right now. So I'm going to sit here with those thoughts, and you give me the general impressions. You're on the ground there in Denver. What are the general impressions to having Peyton Manning under center for you guys?
Yeah, basically everyone's over the moon in Denver. They were over the moon when Tebow was still on the roster for the Denver Broncos. This is Peyton Manning. Now, everyone is basically assuming that he's healthy. You know, the workout tape, which may or may not have been heavily edited, also the throwing for 15 minutes for the Denver Broncos. This led to the near $100 million deal for Peyton Manning. And if he is healthy, Schotte, I mean, we know that's a fair contract. That's market value for the guy, but we won't truly know if he's completely healthy until August, until that first preseason game, until he gets hit, he gets back up, and he's okay. So, you know, maybe a little bit of walking on eggshells, but for the most part, Broncos fans are all in. They're extremely excited, and I would say that 95-96% of Broncos country is just elated at the fact, you know, we got the Elite Eight done. Forget that. We got Elite 18 here in Denver.
Now, Cecil, could you have even imagined a situation in which Tim Tebow leaves Denver and the people are okay with it? Because this seems like one of the most surreal moments of me covering the NFL, that you have a fan base that is so wrapped up into one person, and now it was almost like they were calling for his head towards the end. Like, let's just get Peyton Manning in here. And saying things like, oh, we just need a real quarterback, whereas if you asked him 6 months ago, Tim Tebow was the realest quarterback there was.
Right, and it was always bubbling under the surface for the people that doubted. You know, I don't want to say hated Tim Tebow, but there were certainly a lot of detractors, even here in the Mile High City. I know the nationwide picture was painted that everyone was down. Well, there was quite a vocal group that was against him from the beginning, and you look at this move by John Elway. This was the one move you could make, because we look over the free agent class. I mean, you know, Schotte, you grab Alex Smith and try to replace Tim Tebow with that guy, Chad Henne, whoever. I mean, it just wouldn't have worked with any other player than a guy who has the Hall of Fame credentials like Peyton Manning does. I think John Elway saw a window. He saw an opportunity. And in also getting rid of Tebow, I will say this. This is not an indictment. Like, John Elway could never stand Tebow. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that John saw a championship window open with this team. And, you know, as breaking that story at the Senior Bowl, about Jack Del Rio having interest there, talking with John Fox, the Broncos. They got that hire done just a little bit after we were in Mobile. Well, that's a power move to say we're making a run at a Super Bowl. They could have promoted linebackers coach Richard Smith and been fine. That was a safe move. It's a power move to go get JDR. It's a power move to go get Peyton Manning. They could have played it safe and said, hey, well, Tim Tebow, we'll develop him, we'll see. No, they want to win now. They want to win championships now. And, you know, owner Pat Bowlen, who said after the season, we had a good year, I want a great year. Well, a great year means hoist the Lombardi Trophy. And with Tim Tebow at the helm, the front office didn't feel that he could do that in 2012. Maybe a little bit later, maybe he could develop. I certainly have my doubts as to how much he could develop under Matt Kavanaugh there with the Jets. You know, so maybe that's later on. But as far as right now, if we look at this season, next season, dare I say even 2014, that's what the Broncos truly believe is their championship window, and it's the reason why they made the move for Peyton Manning.
Now, Cecil, the second Peyton Manning got on that roster, even before that, it was assumed that Tim Tebow would be shipped out of town. From your personal perspective, does Tim Tebow leaving town have more to do with A, John Elway just being sick of him, B, hopes against a fan insurrection if Manning were to falter early on, or C, does this have more to do with CAA? Because frankly, you and I both know that what CAA wants, CAA gets.
Exactly, yeah, and there's certainly, I think that latter point is a very strong indication as to why this move happened. I also think, just from getting a feel around Dove Valley, and certainly that press conference when Peyton was introduced was crazy, but the feel that you got, and even the uncomfortable questions that Manning was asked and asked again, even though he'd already answered him that day, about Tebow. What about Tebow? What would you do with Tebow? Can Tebow back you up? All this kind of thing. It was the getting rid of the circus atmosphere that surrounds Tim Tebow, not only from his handlers, not only from his followers that are more Tebow fans than Broncos fans, but just from the media, just this entire, everything that encases Tim Tebow. I think John Elway didn't want his team to have to be a part of that again. And he certainly didn't want the Hall of Fame quarterback, Peyton Manning, you know, when he says we don't have a plan B, and obviously signing Caleb Haney shows that they better not have a plan B, because the plan B is terrible if it's Caleb Haney. But the point is this, you know, John Elway wanted to show that Manning is his one and only guy. There is no quarterback controversy. If he throws a pick, he didn't want to hear the chance of Tebow. He didn't want the questions in the press conference, hey, could you use Tebow? He didn't want the, hey, why don't we see some wildcat? He didn't want any of those questions. He didn't want the distraction. He didn't want the circus, as a lot of people around Dove Valley have privately called it. Everything that went along with Tim Tebow, in addition to the fans and the handlers, the way that Tim Tebow was handled by the people that helped him decide what to do and what to say and, you know, which charity events to go to and how much money to ask for, et cetera. There was everything else outside of football contributed to the reason why Tim Tebow was shipped out of Denver. The football reasons, you could have stuck with the guy making $1.5 million as a backup behind Peyton Manning, a guy that won you a playoff game, won you the division last year. If it was merely about football, Tim Tebow would still be in Denver, but as we both know, my man, it's not only about football when we talk about Tim Tebow.
Let's switch gears a little bit, because when it comes to pre-draft knowledge, especially at the skill positions, you're my main man to go to, and there was some buzz this week over a couple pro days that we've talked about, Stanford and Baylor, Andrew Luck versus Robert Griffin III. When you look at these two quarterbacks, how do you rank them 1-2, and how close is the discrepancy between the two of these guys?
I think Robert Griffin has a higher ceiling, but a lower floor. I think Andrew Luck has a higher floor, and his ceiling isn't necessarily quite as high. Robert Griffin, if he were to play up to his potential on a team, you know, we'll assume it's the Washington Redskins at this time, if he plays up to his potentials, he's the type of quarterback that can help revolutionize the game. That bucket throw accuracy downfield is better than Andrew Luck. Andrew Luck is more of an underneath guy, throwing to more open receivers, less contested passes. Luck can throw to tight windows. We saw that at Stanford from time to time, but we all know he didn't play in a three-vert system. The one thing you love about Andrew Luck, besides the toughness and leadership and the football intelligence, is the fact that he did play from that pro-style offense. So he will be able to drop back, scan the field, make smart decisions with the football. Now, once in a while, we see Luck, who doesn't have the plus arm. You know, if there is one knock on Luck, I guess it is that, you know, he doesn't have that Flacco-type cannon. But I don't see that as necessarily a bad thing. The guy, once in a while, you'll see Andrew Luck get a little skittish or arrogant in the pocket. He'll try to squeeze in some throws that perhaps he shouldn't. Also, we've seen some zone blitzes. Certainly everyone brings up that Oregon game. You know, we've seen some schemes confuse Luck a little bit. Now, on the RG3 side, obviously deep ball accuracy, bucket throws downfield. He does have that monster arm. He's more of a quick twitch athlete, taking nothing away from Andrew Luck. As you well know, this guy can run. He can run over guys. He's a very, very good athlete from the quarterback position. RG3, a little bit more of a quick twitch guy, more of an ankle breaker. Not quite the runner that Michael Vick was in his heyday, but, you know, very, very athletic, very silky smooth, and so charismatic. If we talk about the two personalities, you know, at the combine or at their pro days, these guys both showing off what they had on the field. But off the field, I think everyone that's been around the two could admit that RG3 has this sparkling persona, like just amazing smile, charisma, personality, everything can really make you fall in love with him in those team interviews. Whereas Andrew Luck, I don't want to say he's quite, you know, kind of dorky like Eli Manning. I don't even know if that's the right word, but he is a little bit more reserved. He's not, you know, quite, doesn't carry the room quite as well as an RG3. So there are some small differences there. But, you know, this isn't a situation where it's Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf. This is a situation like we've never seen before where both of these guys have superstar potential in the National Football League. And honestly, if Indy goes with RG3, I wouldn't blame him. I don't see that happening. That's got like less than a 5% chance of happening. But both Andrew Luck and RG3, the future is so bright. I think I'm going to go buy both of their jerseys as soon as they're available.
All right, and we've got a couple minutes left. Give me your next guy. If you need a quarterback, you're in the middle of the first round, you know, only two quarterbacks have been selected. Who is the one guy that you throw your franchise behind and say, this guy is going to be the face of our franchise for the next 12 years?
Yeah, and that guy has to be Ryan Tannehill to me. It just has to be, and especially you bring up the longevity. I mean, it's not Brandon Whedon, okay? Brandon Whedon can't get out of his own way. And, yes, I believe that Justin Blackman, there are a few quarterbacks out there like this. Justin Blackman helped make Brandon Whedon look better than he actually is. So because of the age factor, because of the fact that he can't really move, because of even the victory formation was done out of the shotgun at Oklahoma State. Are you kidding me? I don't want Brandon Whedon as that third guy. I want Ryan Tannehill from Texas A&M. You know, showed up there as a quarterback, converted to wide receiver when Gerard Johnson was the guy, was a very good wide receiver, run routes, square shoulder the line, come back to the football, extremely athletic, then switch back to quarterback when shoulder problems hampered Gerard Johnson. In comes Ryan Tannehill, shows off that athleticism, had a 65-yard touchdown run. And I think of all the quarterbacks, and this includes Luck and RG3, if you talk about a quarterback's ability to maneuver within a cramped pocket, I give the edge, actually, number one, to Ryan Tannehill. He can really smooth the stride up, kind of step up, climb the ladder, and smoothly evade that pressure without taking off, without breaking away to the pocket, without trying to run through arm tackles. I mean, he can really manipulate and maneuver well inside that cramped pocket. He keeps his eyes downfield. He knows how to throw contested catches. And also, he knows how to throw to the right shoulder. Correct shoulder throwing is something that I think is overlooked in large part by the draft community. You have to have that guy that knows to where to throw. To throw your receivers open is the term that's constantly used. And Ryan Tannehill does have that ability. Now, I hope, because of only his year and a half starting at the collegiate level, I hope that he gets a little bit more time in the pros to develop shoddy, maybe like, you know, a year. His rookie season is kind of a redshirt season. He sits behind a veteran. Maybe he takes over week eight, something like that. You know, I think if you plug him in right away, because he is so raw, there is a potential for things to go wrongly. And you don't want that, especially if you spend that premium first-round pick on a quarterback. But if you get Ryan Tannehill, you get an athlete, you got a guy with some arm strength, some football intelligence, and knows how to help his team win games, a guy that elevates the play of those around him, rallies the troops, is a good leader, a vocal guy. There's a lot to love from my third quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, and I think he's probably going to be a top 10 pick.
I see. So, my man, that's all the time we've got for NFL. Winning a little bit of overtime. You go ice up, my man.
Thanks, Shadi. We'll talk to you soon.
See you, Cecil. Of course, it's Cecil Lammy. You can follow him on Twitter, at Cecil Lammy. You can also catch him just about every day somewhere on ESPN Denver, making the rounds, been doing Colin Cowherd and SportsCenter and all the good stuff over there. You're going to see a lot more of him very soon. When we come back, I'm going to do penance for all this NFL talk we've had. We're going to talk a little NBA with Ethan Noroff back in 30.
I look good. I mean, really good.
Hey, everyone! Come and see how good I look! I'm a man who discovered the wheel and built the Eiffel Tower out of metal and brawn. That's what kind of man I am.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Son of a bee sting, she's turning the entire office against us.
You scorpion woman! Loud noises! I don't know what we're yelling about!
I immediately regret this decision.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show. Mike Shoddy, Ethan Noroff here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. A little bit of an odd show. Played the same bumper twice. That usually doesn't happen. Talked NFL for three segments. That certainly doesn't happen. Of course, special thanks to Cecil Lammy for calling into the program. And as I said before the break, to do my penance for all this great NFL talk, I am going to let Ethan pontificate about the NBA for a little bit. Ethan, sound good?
Sounds perfect.
And the best thing about talking NBA this evening is that Joel Kors isn't here to fill us with his long-winded diatribes. So let's get right into it. Ethan, give me your playoff picture update for the NBA right now.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Let's start in the Eastern Conference. You got a few teams at the bottom of the Eastern Conference with Milwaukee, New York, and Boston all kind of hovering around that 7-8 spot. Milwaukee's been playing some good basketball recently. They hit a little bump in the road, but that's all right. The Monte Ellis trade has worked out for them so far. Scott Skiles has been playing a faster brand of basketball, so they could be a pesky team for a team like the Knicks or the Celtics who are looking to get in. Having said that, the Celtics come into tonight's action just a game and a half behind Atlantic divisional leader Philadelphia 76ers. So there's room for a lot of stuff to happen in the Eastern Conference, and teams are a lot closer than a lot of people would imagine. In the West, it's just as crazy. The Clippers have hit a little bump in the road, let's say, so to speak, with Vinny Del Negro very much on the hot seat, only six games over 500. But they're only three games back of the Lakers, and the Lakers are the third spot in the Western Conference playoffs right now. So you got the Western Conference is also pretty packed. Teams like Utah and Houston are making surges, while Denver is a little banged up right now. Phoenix is also coming on strongly. So it's going to be interesting to see which teams make it in the bottom spots and who might be a problem to top-tier teams like San Antonio, Oklahoma City, Miami, and Chicago.
Now we're looking – let's go back to East for just a minute. We've got Boston, Milwaukee, and New York who are all kind of jockeying for the bottom of the Eastern playoff spots. New York, obviously, where a lot of the – interest has been focused in the NBA with first Jeremy Lin mania and then, of course, Carmelo Anthony coming back and submarining all of the high hopes there. Of course, their coach leaving because of that. Milwaukee, of course, was part of that big trade for the between them and the Clippers, bringing in Monte Ellis. Now, all of a sudden, they have a scoring punch to go along with a decent front court. And now Boston, again, is one of those teams that as great as they were a couple of years ago, you just feel the door closing on them. Which of these three teams do you see making the playoffs but also making a run at them?
I mean, I got to pick the Knicks. The Knicks look like a team that, you know, are interested in making the playoffs, which isn't something we could have said about them earlier this season at certain junctures. I think they pose a lot of problems. Tyson Chandler has been one of the best signings of the offseason. He should have made the All-Star team, and he's not getting talked about enough. His defense has had a major impact in the middle, now from Mike Woodson and the Knicks. And I think they have a lot of offense. They're much deeper than people give them credit for. So that's a team that could make some serious noise if they land the right matchups heading into the playoffs.
Over on the Western Conference, one of the big deadline deals, which was the deal that I think you were clamoring for, Joel was clamoring for, most of the L.A. Lakers fan base was clamoring for. They brought in their point guard, and they brought in probably the guy that many people thought they might bring in, Ramon Sessions. He started to get eased into his Laker role a little bit, and from what I've seen, starting to play a little heavier minutes than when he first got there. How do you see Ramon Sessions shaping the Western Playoff Conference in terms of the Lakers?
You know, the Lakers finally have a point guard, and I say that half sarcastically because obviously Derek Fisher was in the starting spot before his trade and him ultimately winding up with the Thunder after being bought out by the Rockets. But Ramon Sessions adds a whole new dynamic to a Lakers team that simply didn't have one like him before. He can penetrate into the lane, which really opens things up for Andrew Bynum and Pau Gasol down low. He runs well off the pick and roll with Gasol at the top of the key, and Gasol is capable of hitting that 15 to 17 foot jumper from a variety of spots on the floor. He takes Kobe Bryant out of a playmaking role, so Kobe doesn't have to facilitate the offense, which oftentimes leads to tough shots from him. And Sessions has showed a great chemistry with some of the second unit guys in Matt Barnes and Josh McRoberts, two guys whose athleticism wasn't utilized enough with Steve Blake and Derek Fisher as the only real point guard options on the roster. And this really, really changes things for the Lakers because now they have a player who can not only get out and run, but somebody who's willing and able to share a backcourt with Kobe Bryant and make this team better.
I got the chance to cover Ramon Sessions when I was in Minneapolis. I believe Joel was able to cover him as well during his short time there. And Ramon Sessions, first of all, is just a very likable guy. I think that's always followed him from place to place, that he's very personable. He gets along with teammates, gets along with media, gets along with coaches. He's probably one of the furthest things I've ever thought of when I think of a locker room cancer. Also with Sessions, he's a guy that you can't get excited about because he doesn't have any one thing that he does phenomenally well. Sure, he gets to the rack, but he doesn't get to the rack quite like Deron Williams does. Sure, he's able to shoot, but he isn't able to shoot quite like some of the other elite point guards are in the league. And he's certainly not the passer that some guys like Steve Nash, Chris Paul are. But he does all of that very well. He's not an elite in any one category, but he does everything fairly well. And when you put the entire package together on a superstar team like the Lakers, I believe he really is the man to right that ship. And when the rumors started bubbling to the surface that he would be the guy there when all was said and done, whether it was after the trade or before the trade deadline or in the offseason, I really thought that Ramon Sessions is going to be a quality player for this team. And I think he can take them just about as far as Coach Bryant will let them go because he's just a phenomenal addition. Let's go to some of these other players. We got to the trade deadline. A lot of pieces were moved. Some of those pieces end up being bought out. We talked a little bit about Derek Fisher getting traded, and now he's with the Thunder. Boris Diaw is another big name out there. I know you're not huge on these bought-out players, but give me some of the top guys who could contribute for some of these playoff squads.
You know, it's been really interesting. Roni Turioff is now with the Miami Heat. He's going to serve as a reserve big man off the bench for them, capable of giving them some energy, so that should be an interesting experiment. Boris Diaw was bought out of a terrible situation in Charlotte and is now with the San Antonio Spurs. He's known to be good friends with Tony Parker, and I think that's a scenario that's going to work very well for them. We mentioned Fisher, who's now going to the Thunder. I don't like the fact that he played 36 minutes in that double overtime game against Minnesota the other night. I think that's far too many for him, even in extended time. I think it's going to be very interesting to see which guy who's on the move is going to have the most impact. Now, if I had to say one, I certainly wouldn't say Ryan Hollins in Boston now after being waived by the Cavs, because despite standing 7 feet tall and being relatively young and athletic, he just simply doesn't rebound the basketball. It's astounding. If you saw his stats on a piece of paper, you might not even know he was 7 feet tall. I really, really do like what Turioff can bring to Miami, but it's a matter of him getting an opportunity there. So I don't know if he's going to have the largest impact. In San Antonio, you have Boris Diaw. Yes, he's a little bit bigger than he once was, and maybe he downed a few more Big Macs in recent years, but he can still pass the basketball.
He's shown a nice shooting touch, and he should fit into what the Spurs do nicely and give them a nice boost heading into the playoffs.
All right, Ethan, that's all the time we have for NBA Talk tonight and all the time we have for the program. Thank you so much for, you know, your expertise and also carrying the weight with Joel Gone. I personally enjoyed having your voice dominating quite a bit more than his usually does. So, Ethan, give us one last shout-out. Where can the good folks find you online?
Just head on over to BleacherReport.com, cruise over to the NBA section. We got all sorts of good stuff going on there. You can find me on there in a variety of places. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com, username Mr_Noroff, N-O-R-O-F. Real easy to find.
I thank you, Ethan, of course. For Ethan Noroff, for Cecil Lammy, this is Mike Shoddy. You've been listening to the Average Joe Sports Show. Talk to you next time.
Take away our phones, and you can take away our keys, but you cannot take away our dreams.
That's right, because we're like sleeping when we have them.
What you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.